Coming up on this edition of the Golf Digest podcast, we discuss Paul Casey's repeat win at the Valspar Championship and have a discussion with best-selling author James Patterson.
My God, my swing feels like an unfolding lawn chair.
Well, why do they even have one if you're not supposed to hit it there?
Because it's fun! We're having fun!
What is this, custom? Mine's off the rack.
I wish Tiger Woods was here to help me with this.
We'll do it live!
Welcome back to the Golf Digest podcast. I'm Alex Myers. Today, I'm joined in studio by Sam Wyman and Keely Levins, and we've got Ryan Harrington on the phone. Guys, we got to start, obviously, with Paul Casey. A big win at the Valspar Championship. His, repeating what he did last year, and I feel good for him because last year no one wanted him to win. You know, everybody was rooting for Tiger, let's be honest.
Tiger.
And, Paul Casey did that. Post a low number a couple hours before the leaders, wasn't really in the heat of the, final round pressure. It ended up holding up. He ended up winning. Again, he upset Tiger, everybody was rooting for. So I'm glad he kind of did it on final round with Dustin Johnson in the final group. It's just his third PGA Tour win, though, Sam. I mean, it's still kind of surprising, a player of that caliber.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to give you the very boring answer, which is that I think Paul Casey is a perfect embodiment of how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour, because it's just, he's obviously an upper echelon player, has been for the better part of, I guess, 15 years or so. For a player of that level, I think was as high as third in the world,
mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Third in the world.
To win, before yesterday, to win only twice on the PGA Tour was like a gaping hole in his resume. And even the way he won yesterday wasn't terribly sexy. Like, he missed a putt on 17, mm-hmm. had to execute on 18. It's just kind of ugly, but guess what, the guys who you notice not delivering on Sunday are usually the guys who at least put themselves in that position. And for a number of years he was the guy who would string together 36 holes, 54 holes, and wouldn't get it done. And even yesterday, he it's more about persisting. And, I think a guy like that deserves to win more than he does. And he's, again, even if it's not always pretty.
Yeah, I think it's tough to get, incredibly excited about it just in the fashion that it happened. Dustin Johnson really did not play anywhere close to his ability. And I feel like we've had a few tournaments so far this season that have ended like this. It's been this kind of limp to the finish, which yeah. is, that's not like a dig or anything, because I think that's a very important way to learn how to win. Like, when you don't have your A game and you are still able to hang on and get it done, like Ricky. That's good. It's just not as exciting for us to watch.
Sure.
And especially now that it's been several events like this, I'm ready to watch just a big birdie duel,
right.
Well,
yeah, I mean, part of that obviously is the course, Innisbrook. Ryan, I know a few years ago, I think it was Jeff Shackelford who did it. We did a player survey of PGA Tour courses, and Innisbrook checked in, I think, at number 9.
Yeah,
the favorite.
Sneaky tough.
Sneaky, tough, and sneaky well-liked by the players, Ryan. I don't know. I've played it. I also played it in the dead of summer, which was not the time to go to Florida for any type of golf trip. But I even saw some of the pros commenting that on TV it never really looks that great. But, Ryan, maybe why do you think it gets the respect that it does from the tour pros?
Well, I think it's a really challenging golf course, which a lot of these guys, I think, would rather be playing than not. And mm-hmm. and it's not a typical Florida golf course. It's got a lot of undulation. They were talking about that on the broadcast a lot, but it's really true. It's not your typical Florida course where you're just trying to avoid water everywhere, avoid houses everywhere. And so, I think a lot of the players respect that and like that. And, Paul Casey is a really good ball striker, and so it's not surprising to see him do well at this event. And, I'm going to pay him some due. I totally agree with you, Keely, that it wasn't necessarily the sexiest finish. It wasn't, beautiful golf here. But he beat a field with Louis Oosthuizen, Bubba Watson, Dustin Johnson. I mean, those are our major champions. Mm-hmm. And they all, couldn't put any heat on him. And so I got to give him a lot of credit, particularly, too, after what happened a few weeks back at Pebble Beach, where, you know, he didn't necessarily come through in the end here, and that cloud started hanging over him again. So, you know, it's obviously a spot that he's felt comfortable with here the last 2 years. And, you know, I got to give him credit because he grinded it out on a really difficult golf course on a really difficult day. And that, to me, is a good sign of a winner.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We do have to give him some credit because if he had lost, we would have said, oh, same old Paul Casey blowing a 54-hole lead. I think he'd be the first to admit he hasn't been great in those situations, mm-hmm. not that he's had too many of them. But he did get it done, and you're right. I mean, the end result is the end result. It's a win. Now, Ryan, what do you think, though? You know, I kind of moved him up into our Masters rankings. He's now kind of, you know, he's always kind of this sleeper pick heading into the Masters. He has a great track record there. The last 4 years, T6, T4, sixth place, and a T15 last year. But obviously, he's never really seriously contended at any major on a Sunday. So Ryan, where do you fall with picking him for the Masters?
Well, I think he's definitely somebody to watch because, like you said, his track record there is so impressive, and he's never come into the event though with kind of some momentum. Like I think he's going to have here. Well, obviously he did after he won Houston.
Right, that was 10 years ago now.
But yeah. That was 10 years ago indeed, and so I think you know the toughest part for him is going to be that history doesn't shine very well on guys who've played multiple Masters who haven't gotten it done beforehand. I mean, he's 41. He's going to have played, you know, probably more than 10 times here at Augusta. And, you know, except for Sergio a couple years ago, you know, guys who win at Augusta usually are doing it earlier in their career, or at least after having only played a couple times at Augusta National. So I think that history is going to counter the good vibes he's got. But I think mentally he's probably in as good a frame of mind as he's been in going into this tournament in years. And so there's no reason to think that he can't contend. It's just a matter now, obviously, of if he can execute those 4 days.
Well, I was going to say, not only is he someone who hasn't won at the Masters in his time there, how many guys can you think of who have played in the Masters in their 40s and have never really been in contention in a major before?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like right. O'Meara, Mark O'Meara won a major, right. His first major in his 40s. I mean, other guys have done that. But O'Meara, I'm sure, although I'm sort of drawing a blank, probably had some close calls prior to that. And certainly he went on to win another major that year in the British Open. But it's very rare for a guy to break through and win his first major when it's his first time really contending in a major at that
right.
age. You know, it happens with other guys. I mean, there's a lot of guys who kind of, you know, Keegan Bradley, Ben Curtis, Sean McKeel, who have, you know, jumped at the chance to contend in a major and have done so, but none of them have done it at a Masters. And, you know, none of them have done it at that advanced age in their career.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. His best finish ever at a major was at the 2010 Open Championship, T3, but that's the one that Louis Oosthuizen ran away with. So he was probably 10 shots behind the winner.
Yeah.
And that's the closest. The T4 at the Masters, it was a backdoor T4 3 years ago. He shot a 67 in the final round when Willett won. He ended up 4 shots behind Willett still. So, you know, he really has never – I mean, we talked about this – we've talked about this with Martin Trainer recently. We've talked about this with some other guys, some of the mental stuff of breaking through and winning. And it, you know, it seems like there are guys who can just win that first chance they get. But at a major, it's a little different.
At a major and at a Masters.
And at a Masters.
For some reason, I feel like the Masters is a whole other level. And it's not like you can play the whole inexperienced card because he's played the golf course and the tournament enough where he has a reservoir of knowledge to draw on. But for some reason, you just don't see guys – you know, capitalizing on that one chance. You know, I guess, you know, Danny Willett and Charles Schwartzel did it, but they did it even then. They were, for some reason, I feel like being around as long as Casey has, in a strange way, is a knock against him.
Yeah.
It shows he hasn't done it before.
I think he's the perfect guy for the each way bet over in Europe, where you bet the guy to win, but then you bet him to finish in the top six.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
He's a very good top six pick.
Yeah.
You know, that's where you like him because he is very consistent. We saw that streak at the end of the FedEx Cup playoffs when he was... You know, he almost won the FedEx Cup playoffs without even winning a FedEx Cup playoff event. That's kind of what he does. He just top fives you to death. He's back to number 11 in the world, so he's probably going to get into the top 10 again pretty soon. As Sam mentioned, he was all the way up to number 3. But yeah, you know, speaking of mindsets, it's interesting because we had a guy this week at the Valspar at the beginning of the week, Patrick Reed, he's the defending Masters champ. He said, looking at his results, yeah, I'm not playing quite as well on paper heading in, but my state of mind is better than heading into last year at Augusta. I'm feeling fantastic. 2 days later, he's on the range
with David Ledbetter.
With David Ledbetter, who he's never worked with before, after his
wife.
It
can get away that
call. Yeah, exactly.
Get away that quickly there.
Well, it sounds like his mindset was fine, but his wife's mindset was not great.
Well, he did shoot. You know, it's not like he was playing poorly this year. He just only won top 10 in eight starts, and that came in the fall at the in Shanghai. You know, a lot of T20, T15, that sort of stuff. But then at the Players, he was in contention, you know, sort of going to Sunday, shoots a 78, shoots a 77 to start the Valspar. After working with Ledbetter for, you know, an hour or whatever, he shot a 75 the next day. So, Ryan, I'll start with you. What, you know, what do we make of hit the state of his game right now? I dropped him out of our Masters ranking, which is tough to do as a defending Masters champ, but there's just too many question marks, I think, right now.
No, I agree. You know, as much as I think he's trying to coax himself into believing that he's, you know, playing well and he's got a swing and the right frame of mind, obviously I don't think that that's been the case. And the last couple of rounds here are proving it even more so. And, you know, he's going to have such a complicated week to begin with the Champions Dinner, with all the stuff that goes on with being the defending champion. You know, at least if you ask me right now, it definitely looks like he's going to, you know, struggle, I think, that week. And he's not coming in the frame of mind that I'm sure he wants to be.
What do you think, Keels?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to watch a defending champion put up those kind of numbers and feel good at all about his chances. And I think Ryan's right. I think that there's a little bit of, you know, like, fake it till you make it, just kind of like, oh yeah, no, like my head is great. Like, yeah, my game's not there, but oh man, mentally I'm in the zone. And I mean, I respect that idea of trying to talk yourself into a good frame of mind, but at the end of the day, if you're like barely breaking 80, something's got to change.
It's also a little bit, it's a little bit like Money in the Bank. I mean, he's won a major. So if you're going to compare his mindset now to a year ago.
Yeah, that's true.
The big difference is now he's won a major champion. Right. So you have every right to feel good about your life and maybe even your game, as opposed to when you're still trying to prove that you can get over that next hump.
I just wonder, Keely, I don't know how many instructors you've worked with in your life. Just switching, you know, not that he's switching. He's still staying with his longtime instructor, he said. But just, you know, what do you think that does to someone? I mean, it's within a month away before a major championship.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to it personally, but just from the number of tour players that I've worked with and coaches that I've worked with, there is always that kind of like feeling of unease when you see someone just like tap in a random teacher, you know, like during a tournament even. It's just kind of like, where, you know, where's your head at? Like, what are you looking for? Just like some sort of magic fix. But at the same time, like, we've seen a lot of really great players be fine when they leave their main teacher. Like, Arya Dutanagarn left Gary Gilchrist and, you know, continued to win. I think that, I mean, I think it totally depends on the player, and I don't know Patrick Reed well enough to be able to tell if this is going to be a good or bad thing for him, but obviously it just kind of shows that he's unsure about something.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, it really depends on the degree to which they're changing things. If it's like, if you're seeing him on the range on Friday morning, it's like, what time you tee off? You tee off at 11?
Let's
rework the grip. You know, like, I mean, you know, if we're talking about like minor, you know, setup, takeaway, I mean, everything to a tour pro is huge. So you can't minimize anything. We certainly see it all the time with guys changing their putting stroke or little changes in the putting, and there's immediate dividends. It's very rare, especially mid-tournament, where you see something
a full
sort of
swing change.
But we don't know. I mean, it might be
like alignment. Like, sometimes that can happen. Like, you don't even notice, and all of a sudden your feet are going 10 yards right, and you just need someone to tell you that, and then you're fixed.
Yeah, and again, to be clear, he did say he's still working with longtime coach Kevin Kirk. He was working with David Ledbetter because he happened to be in town. Although, again, his wife had called him. We'll see. We'll see what ends up happening. But again, I guess we're all kind of a little down on Patrick Reed's chances of defending at Augusta. From one struggling American to an American on the rise, Keely.
I am an American on the rise.
Well, you are an American on the rise, too. Yeah, it's a big, big year for Keely. No, Nelly Korda, the younger sister of Jessica Korda, of course, a runner-up at the Bank of Hope Founders Cup, Jin Young Ko was the winner there, but Nelly Korda, T2, she has now moved up to number six. That is important because she is now the top-ranked American female golfer in the world. Tell us about
Unreal. I'm all in on Nelly Korda right now. I think that she's been a really interesting player to watch. She's super young. She's 20 years mm-hmm. old. But she's kind of been on our radar ever since she was 14 because she played the U.S. Open at Sabonic, made the cut. And I really respect how she's had this, like, very, like, quiet, kind of gradual career. Like, she didn't just all of a sudden start trying to, you know, like, pick up every exemption she could. You know, like, she played on the Symetra Tour. And she, you know, qualified through for the LPGA through playing on the Symetra Tour for a full season. And I think it's just been, like, a very kind of natural progression for her. She had her first win last year, and, you know, now she's played five events, and she's been in the top 10 in every single event. Like, she's number one in greens and regulation. She's number one in birdies. Like, it's all kind of clicking for her right now, and I think it's really fun to watch. I mean, obviously, all the Kordas are amazing athletes. Yeah, I think she's just, like, full of potential. I'm excited.
Yeah, no, I think all of golf is excited because, let's be honest, you know, an American yeah. great golfer leading the LPGA really does wonders for that tour, at least in this country. Obviously, we've seen Michelle Wee come along, and who knows what the future holds for her. We've seen Lexi Thompson come along, and at times she's looked like she's going to be dominant, mm-hmm. but then she's kind of fallen back. I think she's number nine right now.
Yeah, and she wasn't playing at and Bank of Hope, okay. so that's part of the reason.
Right, the turnover.
Yep.
But still, you know, I think the casual golf fan would just assume Lexi Thompson's kind of the number one mm-hmm. American player. But now you have Jessica Korda nipping at her heels. She's number 12. You have Nelly now up to number six. How important is it for, you know, an American star, I guess, for the LPGA?
I think it's really important. I mean, and that's not to take anything away from some of the really popular international players. I mean, when you're out at tournaments, like the fan clubs that some of these players have, like, Sung-hyun Park, like, she has a fan club from Korea that, like, flies to the U.S.
Wow.
like to cheer
okay.
her on. Like, it's a really big deal. And right. in the same way, you know, like, in the way that those South Korean fans are rooting for her, American fans like to root for the best American. So I think it's a great thing for the tour. And I think that having both Nelly and Jessica playing so well is just, like, it's kind of a cute, fun thing to kind of, like, latch on to. Like, oh, these two sisters, and they look alike, and they're both so athletic. And, like, I think it's a really easy thing to rally behind.
I hope it actually can propel, too, Jessica to mm-hmm. continue to play well. She seems to have these spurts where she plays so well, and then she kind of fades away. And, you know, that seems to be the thing right now for a lot of the top American players. Lexi plays well at times, but then kind of seems to struggle a little bit at times. And if one of these players, if Nelly can be the one now that kind of inspires the rest of them that, hey, you know what, let me go out and do that. I mean, I think the rising tide theory here could be really good. And mm-hmm. having a new face like her, you know, I was looking at her stats earlier today, and you know, she's played 20 rounds this year. Only once has she shot higher than 71. I mean, she's playing lights out. And I really wonder, or I hope at least it inspires Jessica, because having a little rivalry between the two of them would be a great storyline for the LPGA. And then inspires the rest of the Americans to say, okay, it's time to play. And so I think it's a great thing for the tour.
Especially in a Solheim Cup year.
Go, yeah.
To get the Americans playing well.
All right, let's switch back to the PGA Tour. And we had, you know, a bit of rare news, let's say, with Robert Garrigus getting a suspension. The PGA Tour mm-hmm. came out and announced on a Friday afternoon that Robert Garrigus had been suspended for 3 months for a drug of abuse, mm-hmm. which in their manual means a recreational drug often obtained illegally. That's the quote in the manual. Robert Garrigus, at the exact same time, 2:31 p.m. Eastern on Friday afternoon, tweeted out a statement. So this was pretty well coordinated. And he came right out and said he failed a drug test for marijuana. Of course, Dave Shedlosky did a great profile on Robert Garrigus years ago about him overcoming alcohol and drug addiction. So, you know, first off, we hope, obviously, he's okay. This is just a minor relapse. But, Sam, a lot was made about the severity of the suspension, given that it is marijuana, which now is obviously yeah. legal in a lot of places in this country.
Actually, I thought his statement was remarkable and really commendable, because that would very easily could have been the tact he could have taken, which is, you know, it's marijuana. Yes. It's illegal in some states. So I can't believe I'm getting dinged for this. But first of all, he said, you know, I had a slip up in my sobriety. It's something that I've struggled with. You continue to struggle with your entire life. And, you know, it might be easy for people to say, oh, you know, marijuana is legal in some states. This isn't that big a deal. But marijuana can be a path or can be the start of a path that leads to use of more severe drugs. And so I thought he handled it in a very commendable, classy way. And I would argue, I would probably be on the side that the punishment doesn't really fit the crime because it seems like it's severe. But, you know, I'm not to make light of drug use, but I also feel like we've had this discussion before that, you know, the tour announces these drug suspensions and they're all, you know, journeyman
yes.
type players. They're never stars. So there are two assumptions. One is only journeyman players use drugs, or there's some, and I'm not implying this because I think that's a dangerous road to go down, but you know, the conspiracy theorists out there would say that there's some selective punishment
yeah.
of players.
No, it's a great, you mentioned that Garrigus is the first to get dinged for the drug of abuse specifically, but here's the list of guys who have been suspended. Brad Fritz, Mark Hensby, Scott Stallings, Bhavik Patel, Doug Barron. Now, Scott Stallings has won a few times on tour. Hensby had a good couple years. You know, like Sam said, though, these are journeymen. Obviously, Vijay Singh had a suspension announced. It was later rescinded. He then sued the tour. It got ugly. They just settled out of court last year. But yeah, it is eye-opening when you see these names and you wonder if some of the lesser-known guys are getting picked on. But Keila, you know, let me ask, because we did a video, we've done a few videos on how different things affect your golf, mm-hmm. you know, coffee, caffeine, or alcohol.
Meditation,
which you guys yeah. were in. We even did weed, which neither of you guys
not
were
Sam
in.
And I.
No.
But, as far as you know.
But is there anything to the fact, now he's getting suspended for using a recreational drug. It's separate than these other guys for using a PED.
Right.
But is there anything to the fact where someone would say that marijuana would help you on a course and that you shouldn't be allowed to use it?
Well, first of all, I don't know if they went so far as to say he was using marijuana during a round.
No, not at all.
It's random testing.
I'm just saying he gets tested. If it's in his system, you could infer, oh, it was in his system. And maybe, yeah. You know, with the beta blockers or something.
Sure, right. Sure. I mean, yes. Could that be part of why the punishment is not, you know, there's two types of punishment. One is it's conduct on becoming a professional, you're using
right.
illegal drug.
Right.
We don't want you using illegal drugs, so you're going to be punished.
Right.
The other one is you're using a drug that's going to give you some sort of an advantage over
right.
your competition. I read it as the first. You know, it wasn't really, but you're right. There's a very good possibility that,
yeah.
You know, player X uses marijuana, and as a result of that, his you know, he's in a certain state of mind and he putts better. You know, it's worth mentioning that the video we did, and it was very similar to the video that we did on alcohol, which was, you know, like there's a very small benefit
right.
after like one toke of marijuana, or there can be, I should say,
right.
or like one beer, you're relaxed. This is, first of all, we're talking about like mid handicappers.
Yes.
You know, at that level,
yeah.
you're getting out of your own way a little bit. You're not inhibited in the usual ways that you are. If you have a little bit of that in your system, you swing a little freer, you're uninhibited, and you play. I don't think that same line of thinking applies to players at the top of their sport, where there's obviously, you know, elite competitors and they have to have everything firing perfectly,
mm-hmm.
you know, on day of competition. So.
Yeah.
And I think golf is like one of the few sports that you could even have this conversation
right.
about. Like, because most of the, you know, like doping kind of conversations that I have are more to do with like my little sister is a competitive biathlete. And hi, Chloe. And there's been a ton of issues with doping in biathlon and cross country skiing lately. And I mean, that's like literally getting blood transfusions.
Right.
So like on the one hand, I spend a lot of time reading about that, thinking about that. And then with the tour, it's like, oh, he was smoking weed.
Right.
And it's just kind of like,
right.
it's not on the same level.
Right. And as people pointed out, I mean, you know, gambling is now starting to become legalized. The PGA Tour is saying we're going to get involved. You have guys advertising for alcohol. So, you know, the step to weed doesn't seem like it's that big of a step where then if you use weed, you're suspended for 3 months.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. The PGA Tour is still a pretty conservative organization. So, you know, there is a huge difference in the eyes of a lot of Americans, and I would imagine the PGA Tour would fit into this category. There's a huge difference between drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana.
Okay. Yep. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think the punishment is a little bit severe, but I think in the grand scheme of things, I understand where the tour is coming from. They want to keep their image intact, and and maybe marijuana is, you know, something that's becoming more socially acceptable, obviously, but at the same time, it's not all across the U.S., and so I can understand why they've got that rule in place. 3 months seems like a little bit of a, you know, too much of a penalty there, but I think for Garrigus's sake, maybe it's a good thing. You know, it sounds like he obviously realizes he's gone back down the path he doesn't want to be, and perhaps he needs a little time away to try to, you know, regroup and get back into, you know, a better position to continue on in his career. So it was surprising, obviously, that it all came out the way it did, but you know, I'm just surprised it's the first time that they've caught somebody for testing positive for marijuana. Listening to Garrigus talk about some of the stories from the past, you would have figured this would have happened before.
All right, well, let's move on to something a little different here. Ryan, I know you spoke recently with James Patterson, best-selling author. He's written a few golf books, it looks like. He's got a new one out, Miracle at St. Andrews. He also has, it looks like, Miracle on the 17th Green, Miracle at Augusta. He likes these miracle books.
Still waiting on that Miracle at Rye Golf Club. They allow no carts on the fairway after a rainy day. But
got to pitch him on that. But Ryan, what can you tell us about talking with James Patterson?
Well, it's interesting. I spoke with him. He, you say a prolific writer. I mean, very prolific writer. He's had 140 books with that he's authored or co-authored. Amazing. Some 115 that have been bestsellers on the New York Times list. You know, this year alone, he's got 6 books coming out, including The Miracle at the Masters. He co-authors many of them, but he's got 6 of them coming out this year. So I got a chance to talk to him a little bit. He's an avid golfer. He started the Miracle series in 1996, has got a recurring character named Travis McKinley, who was a former ad writer who hated his job and was a good golfer and quit and decided to try to, you know, try his luck on the pro tour and manages to get out there. And, you know, it's an interesting book. He writes it with his co-author is Peter DeYoung. And they've gotten together. They play golf all the time, and they got together and thought about trying to create this series. And it was an interesting discussion with him because he obviously, like I said, is this prolific writer, but he really does supplement a lot of that by playing a lot of golf. And golf helps him, I think, unwind and keeps him fresh to be able to write as much as he does.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to our chat with James Patterson.
Before we go on, let me talk for a second about Golf Digest Schools. Golf Digest Schools is our new cutting-edge video instruction platform offering more than 250 classes on every part of the game and featuring the leading teachers in golf, from Butch Harmon to David Ledbetter to Michael Breed. Unlike the quick tips you can find across the internet, these are full game improvement programs meant to be followed step by step as if you were working with a pro. It's like Masterclass meets Netflix, but even better because there's the added promise of feedback. To sign up for Golf Digest Schools, go to golfdigest.com/allaccess and use promo code SCHOOLS to get 30% off an annual subscription. Again, golfdigest.com/allaccess and use promo code SCHOOLS.
Well, I'm pleased to be joined on the Golf Digest podcast by author James Patterson, a prolific writer with more than 140 books to his credit and some 115 plus New York Times bestsellers, and of equal importance to our listeners, an avid golfer. And James, thanks for joining us and taking some time to join us on the podcast.
Great, I'm a big fan of the magazine and of the podcast of late. So this is cool for me.
Oh, very good. Well, James, you combine your passion for writing and golf into a third golf-themed book that's coming out here in April, along with your co-author Peter DeHong. It's titled Miracle at St. Andrews, and it brings back the character of Travis McKinley, a former ad salesman who makes it onto the senior tour. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in store?
I think he was a writer, Travis was. Copywriter.
Copywriter, yeah. And even better. Yes.
Well, I think, you know, with Peter DeYoung and I, we were both at one point copywriters at J. Walter Thompson. So, and you know, frustrated by being copywriters, As they say about advertising, I was an advertising writer and then a boss of writers, and but I've been clean for over 20 years now, so. And I think Peter feels the same way. But and we both love, you know, we're both, you know, frustrated jocks and love getting out as much as we can. He and I will play three or four times a year just to keep the friendship going.
Very good. Well, can you tell us a little bit about what's in store for McKinley in this book?
You know, poor Travis. I think it's a really cool series. This is the third one. We had Miracle on the 17th Green was the first one, in which Travis goes from kind of a frustrated, very good, player at his home course, but he goes out one Christmas, early Christmas, and he sees the line putting for the first time ever, and his putting has always been his downfall. And in that first book, he gets on the senior tour. Then we have him down in Atlanta, Miracle in Atlanta, and then the latest one, Miracle at St. Andrews. And I can't imagine anybody who golfs that won't enjoy these books. They're funny, they're real, they're human. Travis, I think, is a really cool character. And this one, he misses out on the senior tour. I won't get too much into it. But it winds up with him in Scotland, and playing in the Scottish Open, and along the way, the poor thing about Travis is that he's constantly messing up in the way that we all do. I mean, it's one of the beauties of golf. I don't know about the real, real good players, but most of the rest of us, you know, screw up. So he misses getting back on the senior tour by a shot, and then. Interestingly, he goes to Q school, and he doesn't get in because he's honest to a fault, and the honesty that he I won't tell you just because it'll ruin the story a little bit, but he's so honest that he goes overboard and he declares a penalty on himself that he should have never taken. But it reads real well, and he is a cool character, and he's a neat guy, and he's got a good family, and it also gets into a little bit of the conflict between a job where you have to travel that much, and also keep your family together. So hopefully all your listeners and readers will get a kick out of the book. I think they will.
Yeah, no, it was an interesting weaving of the game and some of what he needs to do after he's not playing on the tour anymore. And I liked some of the anecdotal things that you brought to it. It was an interesting book. I'm curious.
He tries to write a memoir, which is too tough for him. I mean, nobody knows how hard it is for us writers. And then he gets an opportunity to be an on-air announcing for one of the networks. And he's quite good at it, but he can't stand it. So Peter DeYoung, he's a little bit of he's a tough guy, and he's always tough on himself. And I think Peter keeps tripping Travis, and I try to pick Travis up, and Peter will trip him. And I try to pick him up, and Peter will trip him. So he ultimately has some problems in his broadcasting career.
Well, like I said, third golf book that you've done, the first one coming out back in 1996. What made you decide to try golf fiction?
Peter and I, DeYoung and I, we had played around, and we were sitting. Actually, it's the first book I ever collaborated on. Mm-hmm. I've collaborated now on a lot of books, nonfiction and fiction. But that was the first one, and I had a story in mind, and I sort of said, well, your story might go like this. And after we played the 18, I kind of laid the story out, and Peter said, well, why don't you kind of write up an outline? And this is the way I will work with co-writers. I wrote an outline. Peter then contributed a lot to the outline. And that does two things. One, the outline gets better, and secondly, it really emotionally invests the other writer in the process.
Sure, yeah.
And then we just sat down and went back and forth with the book. And wound up with a book that I think is, I think most, I rarely have read, I haven't met anybody sometimes they'll say your latest Alex Cross wasn't that good, but I've never had anybody say that about the golf books. People do tend to really like them a lot.
Well, you've written thrillers, you've written romance novels, young teen books, how does writing a book about golf differ from some of these other genres?
I don't think, I didn't find it that different. I mean, you don't have any murders. So, you don't have that to fall back on.
Thankfully. I've wanted to kill a caddy or two every now and then.
I wanted to kill myself a couple of times, too. But you have the excitement of matches to keep it going. Just the humanity of our main character, Travis. The fact that this is a dream for a lot of people, that, we all have that little fantasy that we get out there and play above our heads, or, for particularly good players, that idea that they could go out and quit their day job and play on .com or, take it all the way. One of the great things about golf is, on a given hole, you can hit a shot that's as good as any pro could take. What I mean? And I've always felt, that it's kind of unmatchable in sports, in that, you can hit a ball from any distance. It can be from 100 yards, it can be 200 yards into a green, and you just watch the flight of this thing, and it's so beautiful when you do it right and so perfect. And, you hit a shot in from 200 yards that winds up a couple feet from the pin, and no pro is going to do it any better than that.
Sure.
You could go your whole life and you're not going to do a tomahawk dunk, or you're not going to hit a ball out of Yankee Stadium. But you can do, on a given shot, you can be as good as the best pro.
Yeah, no, definitely. That is a great thing about the game.
And it's gorgeous to watch it. I mean, when it's right, it's such a beautiful sport. And, I used to, a lot of time, I play up at Sleepy, I used to play at Sleepy Hollow a lot. I used to work in New York City and sort of go up there real early in the morning. And it's just perfect. There's nobody out, and blue skies, and or whatever, or rain, it doesn't really matter, and you're out there, and it's just a gorgeous time. And then obviously the other thing is, when you're playing with friends, you get out there with some of your really good friends, and it's a wonderful time to for the camaraderie of golf.
How'd you get started playing yourself?
Oh, I think just a fluke. I grew up in Newburgh, New York, and the Palatine Club was pretty close, and we didn't have the money to belong. But I used to sneak on, and I didn't know anything about golf, so I just kind of made it up and figured out how to hit the ball. And the weird thing was, so I would sneak on usually around the 16th, 17th hole, and I usually just kind of play a couple of those holes right at the end of the 18th. And then one summer day, I was out, and I was a little gutsier, and I'm out there, and I'm out in the seventh or eighth hole, and I over the hill I see the pro coming. I go, oh, my God, man, I couldn't run fast enough. I had the bag and the whole thing, and he drives up to me. But he thought I was the son of another member.
Okay.
And he thought I was Charlie Conway. He keeps going, Charlie, you got to come in for some lessons. I go, I'll be in there. I'm going to do some lessons, man. This is the best. One of the funny stories back from the Newburgh days was Tommy Bolt came to town at one point, and he was doing some, event. Charity event or whatever.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine and myself, we got to caddy for him. When we were little kids, like 13, 14, whatever the hell we were. And, Tommy Bolt was known to have this bad temper. And he was a little edgy out there. And the 10th hole at the Palatine Club, he pushed his drive off into the right. And it was into kind of light rough, a little bit of bushes. No problem, whatever. We couldn't find the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy couldn't believe it. He got so mad. We're little kids, and he's yelling at us, how could you lose my ball over here? This is impossible. Whatever. So we finished the 18, and my friend and I were walking off the course, heading back into town. And my friend reaches into his pocket and pulls it, and he goes, got Tommy Bolt's ball. And he found he got the ball on the 10th in the bushes and stuck it in his pocket.
That's great.
So, yeah, great stuff.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you've written so many books, and if I'm not mistaken, you've got like more than a half a dozen titles that are coming out just in the first half of 2019.
Yeah,
or the first few months.
Kind of crazy.
How do you do it? I mean, how are you able to produce so many different titles?
I don't know. We had CBS here at one point, and at that point I was doing these book shots where, like, they were novellas, 150 pages or so. And
mm-hmm.
the journalist, I started pulling out these drawers alongside of my desk, and I'm pulling out the second drawer and the third drawer, and he goes, this is crazy. And then by the seventh, and these are all manuscripts.
Yeah.
And by the seventh drawer, the guy looks at me and he goes, James, you are crazy. I think a piece of it is somebody said you're lucky if you find something you like to do, and then it's a miracle or somebody will pay you to do it. And that's my story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, if I had a dream of being a professional golfer and I could go out there every day and kind of never have a really bad round or not care if I do because I'll get it tomorrow. And so I get to tell these stories. And I have a massive imagination, obviously. There was one point when I was I did like 2,500 pages or so of outlines in 1 year.
Oh gosh!
In addition to two books that I, you know, where I did the whole book. And you think about that 2,500 pages of outlines, and my outlines I always do three or four drafts, so it's a lot of writing. Yeah. And I don't know, you just do it and you keep doing it and you chop wood and eventually at the end of the day you've chopped a lot of wood.
Yeah.
By the end of the month, you've really chopped a lot of wood. And by the end of the year, there it is, 2,500 pages of outlines and two full-length novels. So I'd love to do it. I don't work for a living. I play for a living.
Have you ever had writer's block?
No. No, and I think part of the reason is because I'm always working on more than one thing.
Sure, yeah.
If I get to a chapter and I'm just not getting it, I just go, you know, TBD, and I move on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or if I'm really not getting, I'll go to another book, spend some time with that book. And I think a lot of writers block. Well, for starters, I mean, if it's really, really serious literature, it's a little bit more of an excuse. And when it's commercial fiction, you ought to be able to figure it out. And if you don't figure it out right away, you'll figure it out the next time you do the next draft.
Is there a particular challenge at all in writing stories that have these recurring characters like your Alex Cross stuff or Michael Bennett or obviously in the golf books here, Travis McKinley?
I think there can be. If I wasn't interested in Cross and if Cross didn't keep growing, I think I would just say I don't want to do any more.
Yeah.
I have occasionally retired characters or written a book where I thought I was going to do more and just go, I'm just not that interested in that character or characters. And a couple of them, you know, keep recurring. Michael Bennett, who's got all these kids in New York, he's a cop. He's got like 8 or 9 adopted kids. And then Cross, obviously, I keep doing. Woman's Murder Club, I keep doing. And then some of the kids' books. I do a lot of kids' books.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important to get kids reading. And anybody who's listening, if you got kids, you know, it's not the school's job to get your kids reading. It's your job. And really, it's one of the most important jobs you can have. You know, get them in decent shape. You know, try to get them to eat good food. And they gotta read.
Yeah.
They at least gotta be competent readers. And if they're not, then you're kind of like not doing your job. You really signed up for it, and that's an important thing.
Yeah.
You'll run into so many kids at some levels, and the fact that they don't read reasonably well, it really makes life a lot harder for them than it should be.
Well, I know that's a big deal for you, that you've spent a lot of time and helped a lot of causes with that. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, our son Jack, he wasn't a big reader when he was little. He's a bright kid. He wasn't that big a reader, and you know, and of course, you know, being a writer, that's like, seriously, Jack? But when he was 8, Sue and I said, you're going to read every day this summer. And, you know, he said, do I have to? And he said, yeah, unless you want to live in a garage. but, and this is a key thing, we went out and got him about a dozen books from libraries and local bookstores. And they were all books that we were pretty sure he was really going to like. And by the end of the summer, he'd read the 12 books, and his reading ability went through the roof. And when he took his SSATs, he got an 800 in reading. And so, I mean, that's the, you know, it can go that way. But at the minimum, if you get your kids reading and you give them books that they're going to like, they can also be challenging.
Sure.
You know, they can, you know, I mean, The Wrinkle in Time is not that easy a book, but it's a cool book. And it's not, you know, it challenges them a little bit, but they like getting to the end of it and reading through it, you know. And so it's really important for us to do that, kids and grandkids and even nieces and nephews.
Well, we talked about you getting involved in golf and that you're an avid golfer. What's your handicap right now? How are you playing these days?
What are we playing for?
Just a friendly match. Come on.
I don't know. I had a couple operations the last couple of years, so that hasn't helped. But I'd say it's, you know, it's probably around a 12, 13 now.
Yeah, that's respectable, like definitely.
That.
Yeah.
Not bad. It's okay. I'm playing from, you know, baby tees a little bit. I baby myself a little bit. I mean, that's the biggest issue that I have is just length off the tee right now. The rest of it's okay. No, it's fun, and I can play with most people, and it's I get around, and it's fun.
Do you have a regular group that you play with, or do you just?
I play by myself a lot.
Yeah.
I play with my wife a lot, and I'll play with really good friends.
Okay.
There's not a lot of people I want to hang out with for 4 hours, so I have a few people like that I do. But mostly, I'm out, 5 days a week or first thing in the morning, and I'll get off of. We got Emerald Dunes down here, uh-huh. and then Trump, and then Everglades here, and then Sleepy Hollow, up in Westchester,
yeah.
And most of the places let me go out real early, so I'll be out there, first or second, whatever, and bouncing around. And I'm not like I'm rushing, but if I do 9, I'm usually done an hour 10 or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not running, but if I do 18, it might be 2.5 hours, something like that. And then I'm back writing by. 8:39, 9:30 at the worst. I usually write before I get out.
Do you watch golf on TV?
That's my kind of gig. I'll give you my hole-in-one story.
Okay, yeah.
My wife is she's a good athlete. She was a 4-time All-American swimmer at Wisconsin, and she's very competitive. So a couple of years ago, she had lifetime 5 holes-in-1. I had 3. On February 6th of that year, I had another hole-in-1, and Sue said, well, I'm not crazy about it, but I can live with it. 2 days later, on February 8th, I was out with her. I had another hole-in-1.
Wow.
2 holes-in-1 in 3 days. We're standing on the tee. Does she give me a big hug? No. Does she say, nice shot, honey? No. She looks at me, and she says, you've got to be shitting me, which is a totally appropriate response. For somebody getting 2 holes in 3 days.
Indeed, you said you were 12. I'm not sure about that anymore now. Here, so.
Well, we got the holes in one. I'm good with holes. I have another one since then, so it's now 6-4.
Wow, very good.
Yeah. So the holes in one are working. The rest of the game, not so much. But
Do you watch much golf on TV, or how much do you watch at home?
I watch a fair amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll kind of drift along, maybe watch half an hour or something, and then Sunday if it's if there's some good tension,
yeah.
I'll sit and watch for a few hours. I'm the same way with a lot of sports. I'll watch half an hour of basketball or half an hour of baseball or, and then come back and watch some more. I'll watch maybe, the first quarter, go up and write some, come back, watch the last quarter. Or, with golf, go in and out. And usually Sunday I'll sit there and kind of watch the last 9 holes or so.
When you're watching, are there moments then when you're seeing something and you get that light bulb in the head that goes, wait a second, that's an idea for me, and you jot down something for maybe
a story or how to hit the ball?
I meant more for a book. Yeah.
Every day, I don't get any ideas for books, but every day I will come back from the course with a scorecard that I've scribbled some notes on.
Okay.
So I'm not kidding. I must have 5,000 of
these. Oh, wow.
Some little tip I've gotten. That's it. Now I've got it. And obviously none of them have ever worked.
How do you think Golf Digest stays in business? You gotta keep having ways to search.
Yeah. Every once in a while you get something, lately the last month or so I'm hopeful. A little better.
Do you
get your putting going for a couple of weeks or all of a sudden you're chipping a little better or.
When you're traveling,
usually something gets better, and then something gets worse.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's the way it works for me too. So no, when you're traveling, do you bring your clubs at all, or do you try to play when you're on the road?
Usually not.
Yeah.
Because I play so much. If I'm in New York or certainly in Florida, I mean, I really do. I'm out there 4 or 5 times a week, so I'm not like desperate.
Yeah.
When I was living in New York, I would get desperate, and I would play anywhere. I used to, in the winter there, I'd go out and hit balls on City Island. I'd work, get out to City Island at 8 o'clock. There weren't even heaters out there. And he'd be out there in January, this one crazy friend of mine, and we'd be out there banging balls at, 8, 9 o'clock at night. It'd be like, 20 degrees. It was ridiculous. I remember played on City Island. There's, three or four courses, public courses out there. And we went out, and our thing was, if you wouldn't mind taking a long walk on that winter day, you'd bundle up enough. And if I didn't mind taking a walk, I didn't mind playing golf, even in December and January.
Sure.
So we're out there, and about the fifth hole or so, it starts snowing. And I don't know if you've ever been stupid enough to play in the snow, but at a certain point, you can no longer putt because the ball just picks up snow. You kind of really can't. The ball won't roll anywhere after you hit it. So we get in, and we finish the nine anyway, and we're walking to the clubhouse, and these four guys are going out to the first tee. They go, "Hey, Marty, you think we'll get 18 in?" And it's snowing. I mean, it's like 3 inches on the ground already. You know? And that's, you know, winter golf. I remember playing down in Tom's River area one winter morning, and it was so cold you couldn't get the tees into the ground.
Yeah.
But the course was covered with goose turds. So what we would do is put like two goose turds and tee the ball up on goose turds. And that's the way we went around.
Got around.
So, yeah, you get desperate.
Definitely, definitely. No. So, well, you say you watch a little on TV, and we were talking a little before we started recording here, but do you get to go to very many events? Have you gone to very many tour events and seen it in person?
I a couple at Sleepy Hollow when I was up there. They used to have a senior event at Sleepy Hollow, mm-hmm. So I went a couple of times, which was great. Mostly, I just don't like the crowds. I mean, the Honda's down here now, but I don't think I'll go out there. I haven't in the past. It's just, to me, it's just too much of a pain in the butt. I like going out with my, and I now let's say I played with President Trump. I played with President Clinton. I played with Bush Senior. So I played with some presidents, but mostly I don't think I've played with any of the pro golfers.
I was going to ask that. Any tour pros? Yeah,
it's fun. Yeah, it's fun.
What's the most fun thing about playing with the presidents?
I just hanging out with them.
Yeah.
You know, I did a book with President Clinton, mm-hmm. and we spent a lot of time together. We're both from small towns, and to some extent, you know, we've both kept a little bit of the small town in us. And, you know, I mean, for me, I think it's, you know, I've been poor, I've been middle class, then I was poor again and middle class again, and now I'm rich. And on balance, I prefer being rich. But I'm really glad that I went through poor and middle class, but in terms of my writing and also in terms of being a human being. And I think with President Clinton, you get a lot of that, too.
Huh.
He's seen a lot. He's seen a lot in Arkansas, you know, da-da-da-da. And you know, and we go at it just kind of fun. We just mess around. It's not for serious. We did a thing. Sports Illustrated got us for the book, and I know, you know, somewhere along the way when he was president, they go, "Oh, well, he just makes up scores." And I said, "You know, this, we're not being serious." I said to the writer. He said, "Well, who's better, you or Clinton?" I said, "Well, he's faster at like dropping another ball, and I'm faster at giving a 4 foot putt." You know, so the writer knew that this was just going to be light and fun and whatever. And on the first hole, we both hit decent drives. It was a par five, and then my second off the fairway, I pushed it a little bit into the rough, to put it mildly. And I said to the writer, "Go pick that one up. Make yourself useful." And, yeah, so we weren't like that. And it was just sort of fun. And it wound up being a fun article because we weren't taking ourselves that seriously.
No, definitely.
You know, it's been fun playing with the president. We did, and mostly it's just been, let's just have fun, hit some balls, you know, whatever. And then we played down in Orlando. We did a second tour. And he brought his cousin out.
Okay.
And his cousin had played for University of Arkansas. A woman, good golfer.
Yeah.
You know, low 70s, whatever. And around the second hole, all of a sudden, he goes like, "What are we playing for?" It was my wife and I. We're going to be against him and his professional golfer, you know, whatever. And, you know, so we played him, and then we kicked their ass. So well, my wife, essentially. No, I mean, we won on 16 or 17,
yeah.
Which was great fun.
Oh, that's cool. Is there one golf course out there that you haven't played that, you know, it's on your bucket list, if you will, to
yeah,
get to?
The bucket list thing. I haven't played a lot because I started late.
Okay.
I love Sleepy Hollow. Just in terms, I don't think there's a pretty golf course. Kohler, we've enjoyed out there. What is it?
In Wisconsin, the Whistling Straits, and
yeah. Those are great. We played it a couple times, and we've been lucky. Because we never played it in a stiff wind.
Okay.
I can't imagine playing that thing in a stiff wind. But that's a really gorgeous, interesting golf. There's like 900 and some traps out there.
Yep.
On the golf course. There are traps that are so far from the hole, you can't imagine somebody could have ever hit it in a trap. but I'm sure somebody, well, Dustin Johnson hit one in one of the tournaments. you know, so those are gorgeous. We played Seminole down here a bit. That one's a little too nasty for me at my level. Too much ocean wind. And I played it one time. It was the day before. They have a big amateur tournament down at Seminole. And I played it with three friends. And the best of us, the guys like about a 3 handicap. And the rest of us were in that kind of 9 to 14 or whatever. But I swear to God, we putted the ball off the green like 10 times.
Yeah.
You do a putt there. And it just keep and you know, 3 or 4 times off the green and into a trap.
It's tricky, yeah.
You're kind of like, what? This is crazy.
Okay, so, but a course that you haven't played, is there one on your list that you go, okay, I really would like to figure out a way to get out to here?
You know, yeah, for, you know, anybody wants to, you know, somebody that runs a course, sure, you know, you can, Pebble Beach would be fun. I don't know. Augusta, I've walked Augusta.
Okay.
We were lucky. Our kids, Gary Player's son was in Palm Beach for one. The kids all went to the same school. So he invited us to stay with his parents for the Masters 1 year. And Gary was great. I mean, he took, you know, Sue and I over to the, you know, we got to drive up whatever the hell the road is there, Magnolia Lane or whatever the hell it is. And which was great. Gary was a prince. He was such a nice guy. And, you know, we ate lunch on the veranda there, Sue and I and Gary. And then Sunday he took us out golfing, not on Augusta, but there's another course that he's involved in,
okay,
10 minutes away, and played 9 holes with him. And he had his guru with him, guy, I think he was from Czechoslovakia or something. And he said, you know what the toughest part of Gary Player's body is? Or, you know what the weakest part of Gary Player's body is? I go, what? His teeth. Like, okay. But he was so fit, you know. And it was just a great experience.
Yeah.
And then he told us the last day, he said, look, I mean, you can stay out there because, we were walking around. He said, but my advice is after 9 holes, come back to the house because I'll be doing a play-by-play for everybody here. And it'll be, you know, cool because I really know, you know, the course so well.
Sure.
And he said, what happens is, you know, it just starts, everybody starts, you know, going to the same hole. So you'll wind up so far away from the action, it'll be ridiculous. So we did. We went home and, or back to his house, and then Gary did a play-by-play, which was great.
Yeah.
He can't get up and down from there.
So how about any individual golfer you'd like to play with? A tour pro or some other person that you wouldn't mind spending 4 hours with, or 2 hours even, if you just play 9 holes?
Sure. You know, I play at Donald Trump's course down here, and I see Tiger down here and Dustin Johnson, and I see some of these guys, and So they play with the president a fair amount. You know, I'm not dying to do that. That'd be fine. Why do I want to sit there and like be 100 yards behind somebody on the tee? Well, what's the fun there? That's like, be fun. But I'm not dying to do it.
Okay.
Maybe some senior guys like in his 90s, you know, where I can like hit the ball farther than him, you know?
Very good.
Maybe.
Have you ever had any tour pros reach out to you and say anything about the Miracle At series? You know, have you ever had somebody who goes, you know, I've read these, you know, who's in the game, if you will, and a player themselves, and
I know Floyd a little bit from down here.
Yeah.
And you know, he was in the first book, and he said, yeah, you got the golf right, but he said I would have never lost to that guy. I think that's about it.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Now. Should we expect another chapter in the McKinley series here at some point down the road?
I think we'd like to do one more. You know, do the 4 majors. So there's a good chance.
Very good, very good. No, well, James, I appreciate it. It's been interesting to catch up with you, learn a little bit about your background with the golf and with the book series here. The name of the book again is A Miracle at St. Andrews, written by James Patterson and Peter DeHong, and it's published by Little Brown and Company. It comes out April 8th. And James, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
All right, good talking to you. Hit them straight, hit them long.
You too. Take care now.
All right, bye bye.
right. Thanks again to James Patterson for joining us. You know, golf novels are interesting. I just finished The Prodigy
right.
by John Feinstein. I know you read it as well. I don't know. It was very cool because it had so many tie-ins to people we knew, people we work with. But to me, I don't know, for some reason, we're so into the golf world that writing about a fictionalized tournament, I don't know, I'd rather see like the real thing or read about the real thing.
Right. Well,
do you get that?
Yeah. First of all, I think, I guess I agree with you because I love reading about golf, but golf fiction is a kind of a whole other
right.
Category, and it's a high bar. You know, it's tough to do very well. I mean, late Dan Jenkins was one sure. of the people who pulled it off, but it is very tough to do. And, you know, part of it is because, you know, golf is so nuanced. There's all these different sort of characters, you know, who it's just difficult to avoid the cliched, you know, making the putt on the 18th hole to win the major. And so, you know, it's just right. hard to chronicle golf. And actually, you know, John Feinstein's book I thought did very well. It's hard to chronicle golf in an authentic way, mm-hmm. But also have it be sufficiently dramatic. And I thought the Feinstein book did, and it sounds like I think Ryan enjoyed the Patterson book, so I'm sure, mm-hmm. sure he achieved that as well.
All right, let's wrap up with some awards here. We're going to start with Best One-Day Story, and that's actually the Best Two-Day Story. That goes to Akshay Bhatia.
I knew it.
I want to ask Ryan about him. The young man, we had him on the podcast a few weeks ago. He is 17 years old. He's already said as soon as he turns 18, well, unless he has, you know, he's into the Masters or something, he's going to turn pro. He's not going to go to college. Ryan, what'd you make of his first his PGA Tour debut at the Valspar?
Yeah, he had some jitters. He struggled a little bit, but, you know, so I was surprised that he missed the cut. I thought, you know, he's got a lot of talent. I've talked to a couple of his coaches and talked to some others who say, listen, no, the kid's for real. You know, he's not going to, you know, earn his PGA Tour card necessarily right away, but there's just somebody that they all say, you've got to watch. He's got a special game. He's a lefty. He's 6 feet tall and weighs nothing, but he's got this amazing swing and hits the ball a mile, just like all these young players do. And yeah, you know, I think he was probably disappointed with the way he played here. He's been anxiously trying to get into PGA Tour events. He's been Monday qualifying right. for like a year and a half now in different events and whatnot. He's homeschooled, so he's got a lot of flexibility from that standpoint. And to finally get into one, I think he was anxious to do it. And so I think all in all, he probably is a little disappointed with the result. But I think finally getting one under his belt is a good thing. He's going to try a couple more times here. And then he's going to go over to Europe and play in some European amateur events, the British amateur and the British European amateur, before playing amateur events this summer and then trying to qualify for the Walker Cup at the end of the year. He could be the first player who's currently in high school to make the U.S. Walker Cup team ever, and he's got a really good shot at it. So a bright future. Maybe these last couple of days were a little bit disappointing, but I think we're going to hear a lot from him here as soon as this summer.
Ryan, you really feel like you were surprised that he missed the cut? I just feel like playing your first PGA Tour event, like that's worth, you know, 3 or 4 shots added to your score alone.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there, but I think this kid's got the talent. You know, I've talked to a couple of his coaches who just say, listen, he hangs around, he's played and he's practiced with PGA Tour pros before, so the specter of being at a PGA Tour event wasn't as, you know, I think daunting, quite frankly, as it might have been if he'd just gone sight unseen or he'd never really hung out with any of these guys. But he's practiced with them, he's been at these events, he's been in these Monday qualifiers. And so I think to a certain extent the awe factor just wasn't necessarily there like it would have been otherwise. And I think it just, you know, we're talking about how difficult Innisbrook was to play for the top players. Imagine what it's going to be like for a 17-year-old amateur. And I think he fell prey to that on a couple holes. And so he had a couple bad holes, and that forced him to miss the cut. But, yeah, I am surprised because I think he's got enough talent to at least make a cut here. And I think you're going to see that, you know, in another event here sometime this summer.
Yeah, I think we'll see him make some PGA Tour cuts pretty soon. I think what impresses me most is how much he expected to make the cut and play well. And it reminds you of, you know, you hate to say it, a Tiger Woods. I mean, kind of just not, you know, yeah, I'm here to win the tournament. I think people are like, oh, you're,
yeah.
Oh,
and he's like,
it'd be nice to make the cut. Yeah, he's trash talking John.
Well, yeah, we joked about the trash talking thing, but I think there was some truth to that. I mean, I think he believes he's as good as some of these guys, as bombastic as that really is.
Yeah.
And so, there's good humor in it, but I think he's going to come away actually pretty upset that and kicking himself for having an opportunity here, probably at a course that, you know, It might be a tough one, but it doesn't mean that he couldn't play well. And put it this way, he goes back to defend his title at a couple of these junior tournaments in the next few weeks. I wouldn't want to be a junior in those fields because I think he's going to blow him away.
Yeah, he had it to 3 under in his second round. He shot 72. He had it to 2 under in the first round. He shot 74. So he's the real deal. I'm actually most surprised that this was his debut. How has he not gotten an exemption? I mean, this guy is, all kidding aside, the Tiger Woods of junior golf. He's number one by a mile. He's in the top 10 of amateur rankings, and that's incredible because he doesn't really play a lot of, or hasn't yet played a lot of, big amateur events. He was kind of playing the junior circuit. So, again, I'm kind of surprised that it took this long for him to get into a PGA Tour event. I think we'll see a lot more of him coming up. All right, this week in pros are just like us. Got to go with Luke Donald, who just a few weeks ago was being dragged to the mall.
You love that mall video.
By his wife. And now this week, he's leading after the first day. He's in contention after day two. His wife, Diane, posts another video, this time with the three daughters, about if they're going to watch their dad on TV that day. And the daughters all basically, like, had no interest. One of them was like, maybe for an hour.
Yeah, sure.
I just love that. I mean, you know, unfortunately, Luke, you know, didn't have the best Sunday. But it was good to see him out there again. I mean, he's not, you know, he's 41. He's the same age as Paul Casey. He's been former number one in the world. You know, he hangs on for a top 10. I know he's on a medical exemption. He's trying to get back. He still has probably the best bunker game of anyone on tour. But I don't know. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah, it's like, we can watch Daddy on TV, or right. We can watch this rerun of Frozen again.
Let's watch. Or she said, we like watching YouTube. all right. Our stat nugget of the week involves another veteran. That is Ernie Els finished T7 at the Maybank Championship. That is his 300th career top 10, which is a staggering number. It gets more staggering when you compare it to anyone else. In the era of the official world golf ranking, which goes back to 1986, so we're talking about events that give out world ranking points, he's the first to reach that number. In fact, number two is Vijay Singh at 275. Number three is Jumbo Ozaki. It drops all the way to 240. And then you get to Tiger Woods at 231. So, again, you know, Ernie Els has 6 years on Tiger. Tiger's had the injuries and whatnot. But that's some serious consistency.
It's also worth noting that all those three first players are all guys who played a lot of international golf.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And not to say that the golf isn't as good, but the golf isn't as good as it is.
Well,
if you're playing, week to week on the PGA Tour, a top 10 is, you know,
yes,
very difficult, very tough to crack. Whereas, it's still very impressive on the European Tour, or you know, some of the tours in Asia, but it's fair to say not as high a bar.
Yes, that's a great point, and that's why Phil Mickelson, who is 48, so just a year younger than Ernie, he has 214 top 10s. He's played 95% of his golf on the PGA Tour, whereas Els, you know, pretty split, obviously. You know, and Jumbo Ozaki, I just looked it up, he won 94 times on the Japan Golf Tour.
True.
That's 94 top 10s right there. Wins. So that's pretty ridiculous. But anyway,
Tiger's got a lot of catching up.
Tiger, exactly. Tiger had 7 top 10s last year, so he would need 7 more seasons like that. So he'd be 50 or 49 to get to just to 300. And Els is, you know, he's still showing some life. He's still going to maybe add to that total. So anyway, impressive job by the Big Easy. All right, guys, we didn't mention, we got the big tournament this week, obviously, the World Golf Championship, Dell Technologies Match Play Championship. Guys, this is one of the fun events of the year. I know, Sam, I think you were working on
We were going to talk about that. Yeah,
let's talk about
it. Well, I mean, it was really quick. It was this, you know, it's now how many years into the new pool play format? Three or four years.
Yeah.
And this is versus the old, you know, crazy Wednesday one and done format.
Right. Fill out a bracket. 64.
Which do you prefer? And I think I'm taking the side for my little pro con with Joel Beal is I like the old format.
Okay.
And the idea is because I get it. The new format ensures that the quality of Friday, Saturday, Sunday is going to be better than it would be. It's one and done because there's so much to chance when it's a one and done format, the first 3 days, right? But the upside is that Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday are arguably three of the most exciting days in golf. Wednesday is one of the great days in golf. Right. It used to be.
Used to be, yeah.
When it was that Wednesday where, you know, there was tons of matches going on and they were all win or go home.
Right.
So you lose a lot of that. And, you know, there you have this awkward dynamic now, right, where guys are either assured a spot in the next round after three rounds, or they're sure they're not going to do it. So they have these sort of superfluous rounds that I feel like, you know, kill some of the drama.
Yeah, but what
tournament wants to have the best day of their tournament week be Wednesday rather than Sunday?
I get it, but might as well embrace the fact that it's different. It's already different. It's the most, you know, unique event on tour. So why not you just, you know, own that and go with it?
Yeah, it's an interesting debate. On one hand, like Sam's saying, you don't get the Nick O'Hearn over Tiger Woods quote upsets. Now when it happens, it's like, okay, well, the guy could still maybe win the next two matches and get by. I have to say, I used to think there was too much to chance in the old format. I was excited when they switched to this new format, but I think it was last year in particular, it seemed like every match on Friday was meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
You had guys had already wrapped up their pool, or they call it pools? Yeah, their pool to move on. And so you had these even more meaningless matches than ever. And then you get to 16, and it's still a flip of the coin. I mean, you know, it's either you like – you know, match play is always going to be more up to chance than a four-round stroke play. I don't know. What do you think, Keels?
It's, I mean, I guess I see Sam's point, but you could also argue kind of the opposite, that, like, it's already different enough by being mm-hmm. match play.
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, make it even more different? I don't know. Match play is such a mess.
Yeah.
I don't.
And you know, you get in these pools, which are kind of randomly drawn. I know they go by the ranking, but they draw – you know, so a lot of that's luck too. So I know I'm almost with you. I'm saying I used to think it was too much of a crapshoot. I'm kind of leaning back to it's going to wind up being a crapshoot anyway. You might as well have that cool
that's
first.
That's kind
of
where I'm at.
Couple
I mean,
days.
You know,
yeah.
I get it. There's so many logistics from the, you know, you guys are guaranteed they're playing three times. So you're like,
yes.
You know, if Tiger Woods is playing, you're guaranteed if Tiger
right.
Woods playing three rounds as
right.
opposed to going home on Wednesday, which is
right.
a, you know, would have been a very distinct
right.
possibility. I get
whoa,
it.
Whoa.
Which is possibly why he's playing even this week. It's
sure.
very possible he wouldn't have even gone had he, you know, you fly all the way out there to Austin Country Club, you only play one match, you go home.
Mm-hmm.
That's not ideal. So, and I think they were worried about some guys starting to skip for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's why, you know, invest in a week when you might only get one good round out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think only I saw Adam Scott, I know, is skipping a lot of events, as he always is. I think he's skipping. I think Ricky Fowler is skipping the match play, which is
– those were the two from the start.
Yeah,
at least, yeah.
Which is – that's bizarre. I don't know why he would ever – you know, it's a World Golf Championship. It's one of the biggest events. And he's made runs in this before. So I don't get that. But, all right, of the people who are there, I guess none of us are picking – Patrick Reed, probably, even though he is Mr. Match Play at the Ryder Cup. But, Ryan, I guess I'll start with you. Is there anybody who you've got your eye on? Oh, and first, we should mention there is the opposite field event, Corrales, where Tony Romo will be trying to improve on that 77-82 he posted last year. But we'll focus on the match play, I guess, unless you have a Tony Romo prediction, Ryan.
No, I do not think he'll win. I do not think he's going to get a Masters invite or anything.
Okay.
No,
oh, my God. Could you imagine?
There is no Masters invite, yeah. invite for the Punta Cana, by the way. But, it feels like chalk because he's the world number one. But I'm going to take Dustin Johnson this week. I don't care how he played on Sunday. This is a guy who actually, in the new pod system, has benefited from it because he's been able to advance. You know, his first few years of match play, he had trouble getting out of that first round. Actually, he was a victim of that exciting Wednesday, and in the last couple of years he's been able to get out. He won it 2 years ago, beat John Rahm. I think his game has been on except for Sunday over the course of the last few weeks. I think this is his final prep, obviously, for the Masters, and you know, this is a kind of an event that it's, you know, doesn't require certain things out of him. If he gets on a roll, I think he could play really well, and I don't see any reason why we don't see him move on pretty far in this tournament.
Keels?
I am surprising myself by picking Bryson.
Ooh.
Yeah. 25-1, which,
okay.
First of all, pretty solid odds. And what I like about him for this is the number of birdies that he makes. I mean, we're talking about match play. You don't necessarily, you know, need to be the most consistent. You need to be able to make birdies, and he's fifth in the on the tour in birdies right now. So I think that's going to serve him well in this format.
Okay.
All right. I mean, I think it's a futile effort to try to pick this thing because it's so.
It is.
Like, it's like March Madness. Yeah. Nonsense.
The biggest cliche, of course, is you go with the Europeans because they grew up playing more play. but so based on that, based on his Ryder Cup form, based on the fact that he's coming off a couple weeks removed from a very solid showing, Tommy Fleetwood, 21
odds.
Okay.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the European, quote, dominance. I know John Huggins been chirping. And it is impressive. Three consecutive weeks, a European winner on the tour. Going back to what
Molinari, Rory,
Rory, Casey, right, and now Casey, and apparently it is in the modern tour era, a European has not won. It's never won 4 weeks in a row. So this would be history. But as Sam said, it is setting up for the ole ole oles to keep rolling. And with that in mind, I'm going to take Ian Poulter, former winner here.
You know Tiger Woods?
No, I'm not going Tiger. It you know, this would be like Sam's. This is the one week where I would not pick Tiger because there's just too much left to chance. I'm glad he's at least going and giving it a go. I know he's won a couple times, but I'm going to go with Ian Poulter. And you know, the other two guys that were jumping out at me were Sergio and Rory McIlroy. So
you've been brainwashed.
Europe's taking over the tour, so watch out. Anyway, it should be a really fun week. Obviously, it's one of the cooler events of the calendar as we head and get even closer to the Masters. So anyway, thanks guys for joining us. Thanks to James Patterson again for coming on. And please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done so already. And check back next week to see who our guest is.